Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill, a special edition from the floor of the Canada 2020 Conference in Ottawa. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The Prime Minister confirms Canada is set to join the coalition airstrikes against ISIS. Pending a vote in the House, our fighter jets will help battle the terrorist group in Iraq and possibly Syria for up to 6 months. To break down the mission and what it means, we're joined by Roland Paris, the director of the Center for International Policy Studies at the University of Ottawa.
To discuss the political implications of the mission in Iraq, McLean's political editor Paul Wells and Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes join us from the McLean's panel.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, the show this week comes from the floor of the Canada 2020 Conference. We'll have a one-on-one with former Quebec Premier Jean Charest, as well as Frank Graves, the founder of polling firm Ecos Research.
And we sit down with Green Party leader Elizabeth May, who has released her memoirs, Who We Are, Reflections on My Life in Canada.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
And our allies recognize and respond to a threat that would also harm us. We Canadians do not stand on the sidelines. We do our part.
Canada will soon be taking on a combat role in the coalition efforts to battle ISIS. Prime Minister Stephen Harper presented a motion to the House of Commons on Friday as he rose to address Parliament and the nation.
He began his pitch for aerial strikes by laying out the atrocities committed by the terrorist group.
In the territory ISIL has occupied, it has conducted a campaign of unspeakable atrocities against the most innocent of people. It has tortured and beheaded children. It has raped and sold women into slavery. It has slaughtered minorities, captured prisoners, and innocent civilians whose only crime is being or thinking differently from ISIL.
The Prime Minister has ruled out any ground combat, but says we'll have more than just our CF-18s in the sky. We'll also have a refueling aircraft and two surveillance planes.
Now, Stephen Harper has set a six-month deadline, but says action is needed now because Canadian security is at risk.
Indeed, it has specifically targeted Canada and Canadians, urging supporters to attack, quote, disbelieving Canadians in any manner, vowing that we should not feel secure even in our homes.
The government doesn't technically need parliamentary support to deploy our troops, but Prime Minister Harper is urging opposition parties to support this motion, which is up for debate and a vote in the House on Monday.
But the Commons is divided. NDP leader Thomas Mulcair says this mission is still shrouded in secrecy by the government.
He can't even answer basic questions about the breadth or cost of Canada's military deployment. When did Canadian forces arrive in Iraq, and how many? No answer. What contribution have our American allies requested? No answer. How much will this mission cost? What are the rules of engagement? What is our exit strategy? No answer. No answer. No answer.
Liberal leader Justin Trudeau joined the NDP in the call for a non-combat mission in Iraq.
We know there is a role for Canada to be involved in the fight against ISIL, but there is a clear line between non-combat and combat roles. It is much easier to cross that line than to cross back. It is always easier to get into a war than to get out of one. The Liberal Party of Canada cannot and will not support this Prime Minister's motion to go to war in Iraq.
With Canada on the brink of participating in airstrikes on ISIS targets in Iraq, how should Canadians feel about the mission, the parliamentary debate, and the months and years ahead? To discuss a dramatic week on Parliament Hill and the difficult issues at play, I sat down with Roland Paris at the Canada 2020 Conference. Roland is the founding director of the Center for International Policy Studies and an associate professor in the University of Ottawa's Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. So it looks, Roland, like the country's going off to war, barring some sort of major development in between now and Monday. I guess just first of all, how should Canadians be feeling about the situation we're facing right now?
Well, I think that Canadians should be feeling the way that they seem to be feeling, which is on one hand we have this horrendous situation that we can't ignore of a growing terrorist organization that's using the most brutal methods and seems to have very expansive objectives. So we can't sit back and do nothing. At the same time, I think Canadians have expressed, at least what I've seen in opinion polls, some reservations about the idea of being drawn into a big, especially big ground war. And I think there is a really serious risk that if we were to deploy ground forces, that they could drift into what might become a major ground war. So this motion seems to be carefully crafted to provide a Canadian role that actually minimizes that mission creep on the ground risk.
The parliamentary debate has been fairly fractious, I guess would be the word. The Liberals have come out already and said, we're not going to support this. The NDP, it seems like there's a lot of space between where they are now and where they would have to get to support this mission. How big a concern is that? You know, should we be hoping that all the parties would be on the same page, or, you know, is this just sort of the way politics works sometimes?
Yeah, I think sometimes governments need to make decisions, and they are, in a sense, responsible for making decisions and maintaining the confidence of the majority of the House. It is a little bit different when it comes to the use of armed force, partly because, you know, especially if a mission has the prospect of going on for a very long time, our military are going to want to know that they have a solid base of support, political support back home, and a cross-party agreement is a way of signaling both to our military, to ourselves, to our adversaries, that there's a broad agreement. Now, it's a little bit different when you're talking about a very precise, focused mission, and I think that's one of the reasons why you've got this mission with a six-month deadline. If it were open-ended, then I think there would be almost more of a political requirement to ensure that there was broader support. On the other hand, it's hard to know. We could never know whether there could have been, still might be, an agreement between the government and one or more of the opposition parties. But I think it's beyond question that the government didn't make much of an effort to engage the opposition parties in the way, by contrast, the governments in Britain and Australia did. And that's, you know, that's, I think, regrettable.
When we talk about the six-month timeline, at the end of 6 months, is there going to be much for Canadians to go, okay, well, we did a pretty good job, that was worth it? Or is there going to be, you know, is there any way to lay down markers that are going to be able to tell us that this was worth it, or that it needs to go on longer, or that we need to do something different?
Well, I'm sure it'll be possible to invent some kind of markers, but, I mean, the problem here is that the timelines are so much longer than 6 months. I mean, what are the main elements of this broader mission? We haven't been talking a lot about this, but what is the American strategy? In Iraq, it's to basically establish new Sunni tribal militias to fight in the heartland to dislodge ISIS in those parts of the country. You're not going to have we talk about Canadians providing advice to the Kurdish Peshmerga. The Kurds are not going to fight outside of the Kurdish areas. Other people say, well, we'll support the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army has demonstrated its lack of appetite for fighting in Sunni areas. And frankly, it's a Shia-dominated organization anyway, and moving that into these Sunni areas will just drive the locals into the hands, could just drive the locals into the hands of ISIS. So the Americans are planning on building Sunni militias the way they did in 2005, 6, 7, 8. That's going to take time. It's not going to happen within 6 months. We're not going to see big elements of progress there. And, you know, my guess is that there'll be pressure to produce some kind of, you know, measure of accomplishment. And the measures will be a number of targets struck, as opposed to evaluating the effects, which is quite different than just the actions.
Looking even further than 6 months, where is all of this going? You know, yeah. We've had Afghanistan, we've had Iraq, we've had Syria, we've had Libya. Is this the way it's going to be for 10 years? Are we going to be fighting these little battles here and there? Are we going to be back in Afghanistan in a couple years? Like, is this just something that we're going to have to kind of get used to? Or is there some way out of this?
Well, I mean, that is the $64,000 question. It's a huge question, and no one knows. Nobody could have predicted how the Afghanistan mission went. Nobody could have predicted, you know, in detail at least, how these other operations turned out, Libya, etc. But I think that, you know, looking forward from this moment, that the United States is building a coalition with a strategy that will take many years to unfold in Syria and Iraq. And the strategy in Iraq is actually considerably clearer than it is in Syria. And my own guess is that the United States will elaborate the Syrian strategy when circumstances become clearer in Iraq. They're clearly focusing as a first order of business on Iraq and trying to roll back ISIS. But the plan that they seem to be working on is to stand up these tribal militias. That's going to take time, and you know, this is a multi-year endeavor. The situation in Syria will be much more complex. I mean, they're basically building. There's very little by way of quote-unquote moderate militias there. They're only planning, at latest count, to train 5,000 troops a year. And the long-term play in Syria seems to be build a capable, you know, usable proxy force that can be used on one side to fight ISIS and on the other side to pressure President Assad back to the negotiating table. It's a negotiated outcome that they're actually working towards long-term in Syria.
How much, I mean, it got referenced today in the House. Granted, it's a bit of a political weakness for the Prime Minister, but the issue of the Iraq War in 2003 is kind of frequently brought up in this discussion. It's obviously not a direct comparison between what's happening there now and what's happening, what happened there then, but how much has that changed the way war is discussed and the way war is approached and the way the public sort of interacts with these big decisions?
Well, I think that, you know, it affects our discussion here in Canada in a number of different ways. I mean, we're being reminded of the fact that Stephen Harper, at a different period in his political career, you know, had a different set of views about intervention. Or, you know, there's a debate: is this the same Stephen Harper? My own view is that he's learned a lot, and in his years in government, and in particular from the experience of Afghanistan, and to see his evolution from being the "we won't cut and run from Afghanistan" to the kind of resignation that this is a hopeless mission has to be handed off to the Afghans. There is every good reason in the world for a rational person, Canadian or otherwise, to hear that Canada's going to war in Iraq and to say, hold on a second, what exactly does this mean? How long is this going to take? What are we actually buying into? That's not to say that we shouldn't do anything. I mean, as I said at the outset, the doing nothing has allowed a problem to fester. But we should be very, very cautious, as I think most people are, given the sorry recent history of Iraq.
That was Roland Paris, the founding director of the Center for International Policy Studies at the University of Ottawa.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. And I'm joined this week by Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great. Thanks.
And, of course, this is a special edition of the Maclean's panel because we're here on the floor of the Canada 2020 conference, but we're not really going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about Iraq, specifically the Prime Minister's pitch to the House of Commons today. John, we'll start off with you. You were in the House of Commons watching that from the press gallery. Do you think that the Prime Minister made an effective pitch to the nation for why we should start in a combat role and send our fighter jets over to Iraq and possibly Syria?
I think in balance it was pretty effective. But almost before thinking about the content, you have to think about the timing. This has taken a long time for him to get around to it. You know, it was some days ago that he floated this idea of a combat role in an interview with the Wall Street Journal in New York. It's been days since the Brits did a much more responsible seeming parliamentary process to build a bipartisan consensus in their House of Commons and this kind of thing. So the Prime Minister has taken a lot of time to get to this point. Now, that said, His speech today was quite effective, and I thought he sketched the parameters, laid out very clearly he didn't mean for this to become a combat mission with boots on the ground, combat mission that's an airstrikes mission. Some of the main points, you know, he sold them quite effectively. Whether he's ragged the puck too long to get to this point is though a serious question.
Paul, did the lack of urgency play into this at all, or will it in the end, in the eyes of the public?
I don't think it will in the end. I was struck by the modesty of the Prime Minister's project. This is an extraordinarily circumscribed thing. He's getting a six-month mandate. If he wants the mission to extend beyond that, he's going to have to re-ask. Six fighters. That's a one-third smaller deployment than France is offering. And specifically ruling out any ground involvement by Canadian troops. I mean, we're looking at probably something close to 1/20th the size of the deployment that John Chrétien sent to Afghanistan in 2002 or 2003. And so Harper wants to ask for so little that if the opposition parties say no, they come off as essentially quite chintzy.
So, John, is the opposition stuck in a tough spot here with this one? Because on one hand, they're saying these terrorists who are beheading people and raping women and doing all sorts of atrocities, they need to be stopped. But they don't want to take part in the actual action that will physically stop these people from doing these crimes. So are they stuck in a really tough spot here?
I think they are. And here's how they've gotten themselves stuck. They've allowed two quite separate questions to get blurred together. One is the question of, what is the mission that Canada is being asked to carry out, and what's the context for it? It's a limited mission, as Paul says, in the context of an international coalition pulled together by Barack Obama, still a very popular president in Canada. So that's the mission. They've allowed that to get messed together with something else, which is the way the Prime Minister plays parliamentary politics, the fact that he hasn't really respected Parliament up to this point in this thing, that he hasn't done the normal stuff of briefing the opposition leaders or their defense critics on what's going to happen. You could go down a checklist of things you could have done to make this seem like a more methodical, more respectful process. Instead of isolating that aspect of the Prime Minister's way of operating, which I think either Thomas Mulcair or Justin Trudeau could have done, they've made that case but allowed it to blur almost sentence by sentence into a kind of, I would say, not very convincing denunciation of the mission itself. And I think that's where they've got themselves into trouble.
And Paul, is it fair for the opposition parties to be comparing this to the former war in Iraq? Because that was in both opposition leaders' speeches today, from Justin Trudeau and from Thomas Mulcair. They seem to be trying to link these two things. Obviously, the former one was a much worse war at that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to make the comparison, but it invites the comparison. And what strikes you is the differences, at least as much as the similarities. This is not an attempt to change the regime in Iraq. It's actually an attempt to prop up the regime in Iraq. It is not a sort of classic industrial war with hundreds of thousands of troops involved. It's very small, so small that you can ask whether Western involvement would make any real concrete difference. You know, and so when people say this is just like George Bush's war in Iraq, my answer is no, it's not. It has its own problems. It's hastily improvised against an enemy that is far more diffuse and far more poorly understood. But this isn't George Bush's war. It's Barack Obama's thing.
There's an old saying that, you know, generals always want to fight the last war. This seems to be a case of politicians not wanting to fight again the last war they didn't fight. You know, it really doesn't work.
And I found it very interesting that we saw the Liberals sort of take on the exact same line that the NDP had been pushing for weeks now. And now all of a sudden it seems like Justin Trudeau, just before the Prime Minister's announcement, has been the face of the opposition narrative on this one, simply by taking on the other opposition party's narrative in the first place.
But Trudeau is to some extent the only interesting player in this. He's the valence electron. If there was a fight against Islamic fundamentalism at low cost, you knew that Stephen Harper was going to be involved. And you were pretty sure that if Stephen Harper wanted to send the military somewhere, Thomas Mulcair would say no. So the interesting question is, which side is Trudeau on? And I admit to being surprised that he's on the let's not do it side. But I keep remembering this week, I keep remembering Jean Chrétien during the first Gulf War. Most of his critiques of that limited airstrike-based intervention by Brian Mulroney didn't make a lot of sense. Send the ships and then bring them back. Have the guys in the air on Tuesdays but not on Thursdays. But after it was done, Chrétien won a large majority government in the next election and buried the Progressive Conservative Party. Maybe that's the precedent that Justin Trudeau had in mind this week.
John?
Just to pick up on what Paul was saying there, though, an interesting way to think about this, and I almost hate to take such a serious international policy decision and boil it down to an electoral politics calculation, but what the heck. One way to think about the problem for the Liberals and the NDP in the last few elections was vote splitting on the left, right? This is a common argument about how Prime Minister Stephen Harper stayed in power. The beauty of the Justin Trudeau experiment to date was his reassertion of the idea that, hey, maybe you can straddle the center in Canadian politics. Maybe it doesn't have to be a polar thing where you're either splitting the vote in the right or splitting the vote in the left. Maybe you can be a center-straddling party. The problem with this particular moment for him is that, perhaps out of conviction, I'm not sure why, he's allowed us to revert back to what we were talking about, just two parts of the spectrum. There's no center here. There's a left of center position and a right of center position. Not the most advantageous place if you're a liberal who's trying to be the middle. You know.
And then he's blurring the lines between liberals and NDP now by taking on a few
NDP or is he simply like, you know, lumping himself in with the NDP again, at least on this one issue.
Yeah.
You know, let's not overstate the point here. The Canadian elections are not won or lost generally on foreign policy. And the point here is that we're a year out, but on the increments, on the edges, this has to be a point where Conservatives are saying, hey, we've had a bad run for a long time here, and now we're looking at a way of repositioning the Prime Minister that may be advantageous.
And then finally, just the exit strategy for the Prime Minister. The opposition parties are saying if we hit that six-month mark, we could extend it even further and then further, and they're saying it could end up like Afghanistan, where we go 11 years on this mission. Do you see the Iraq mission as it stands right now similar in that sense of we could see this go on for years?
We could, but in really small increments, you know, and at political risk to the Prime Minister every time he re-asks. Let's assume that that six-month window is the window that he uses if he renews. I mean, that's a quarter the length of the extensions of the Afghanistan mandate. Those were two-year extensions. And so four times as often, he's got to go before the House of Commons and relive this psychodrama. I think that reflects Harper's low level of comfort with what Barack Obama and this cobbled-together coalition are doing. I don't think Stephen Harper is entirely comfortable with what he's getting into. And so I think he's built his own caution into this process.
John, do you think it'll be a multi-year mission?
You know, Cormac, I'd be lying if I pretended I had any kind of insight into how long some of this is going on. I'll say this, though. I agree with people who say that the Sunni-Shiite struggle in the Middle East is very fundamental, deep-rooted, and somehow it's going to keep playing out for a long time to come. So to the degree that Western powers have to introduce themselves into that struggle, I guess we're always going to be at risk of, we're a NATO country, you know, we're always going to be at risk of being pulled into it.
All right, that's the Maclean's panel at the Canada 2020 conference. I'm Parliament Hill reporter for City News and Rogers Radio, Cormac McSweeney, joined by Maclean's political editor Paul Wells and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Thanks very much, guys.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, we continue from the floor of the Canada 2020 conference as we sit down with former Quebec Premier Jean Charest and pollster Frank Graves. Later, we speak with Green Party leader Elizabeth May about her political memoirs.
Welcome back to a special edition of Maclean's on the Hill, being recorded from the floor of the Canada 2020 conference in Ottawa. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we speak with former Quebec Premier Jean Charest, and Green Party leader Elizabeth May sits down to discuss her political memoirs.
But first, as we mentioned, we are at the Canada 2020 conference in Ottawa. It brings together some of the country's most well-known political minds to discuss a variety of issues facing our nation, from infrastructure to the environment to cybersecurity. Maclean's conducted a wide range of interviews and produced a digital show recapping the panels and the discussion at the conference. To check it out, go to Maclean's.ca.
With Canada now committing to a combat role in Iraq, international conflicts have taken the spotlight in federal politics. Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sits down with Frank Graves, a founder of the polling firm Ecos Research. The two discuss how Canadians view our country's role on the international stage.
I want to ask you first about one element of that. That's the view of Canadians on the international sphere, where Canada should be in the world. I asked specifically because Liberal leader Justin Trudeau, you know, waded into that in the context of Iraq. How do you think people's views of the place of Canada will have changed, and what are the sort of salient factors we should be aware of on that?
Well, it's definitely in flux, and attitudes to the external world and how we should be dealing with it have been changing quite a bit in this century, and all that changed in a whiplash-like fashion following September 11th, where the real focus was on security to a degree that we'd never seen it before. We've seen that security ethic, which gripped Canadians and Americans in a kind of upper North American unity, has relaxed its hold and is now being replaced by a view that while security is important, you know, maybe some of that almost obsessive focus on security has not necessarily insulated us from zero risk or made us risk-free, but it's also cost us a lot of our core values, such as civil liberties, freedom. Maybe even our economy has been mired down as we've been, you know, focused on these issues. So we see that Canadians are showing considerably less focus on issues of security than they did in the past, and saying maybe we should be returning to some of the foreign policy toolkit that worked for us so well in the past.
Such as?
Such as, for example, Canadians nostalgically remember the period where Canada was more known as peacekeepers rather than peacemakers. They also know that some of our really salient contributions on the world stage have not been as sort of smaller versions of American military muscle, but as diplomats or experts in development and aid. And so when you think about the array of the three Ds that we used to talk about, defense, diplomacy, and
development,
yeah, the development, which also I think includes trade now in the Canadian mindset, then I think they're saying we'd like to rebalance things, you know, that this somewhat more chauvinistic and militaristic period, which did find some favor with Canadians.
Canadians were proud of Afghanistan in many cases.
They were, but then in the rearview mirror, decisively, the view now is, well, you know what, I don't think that all those efforts... Most people say they either move the yardsticks backwards, things are actually worse than when we came, which is a tragedy given the human and economic cost, or they say we spun our wheels, we really can't detect the difference. Only about 25% of Canadians believe that we've actually made a positive difference for all this massive expenditure that's gone on, and that applies as well to Libya, and the view on Iraq, where we didn't get involved instructively, was that was an utter disaster. Canadians
are happy we weren't in the
And here's the people when they note this, the fact that Canadians, you know, and our government made this sort of moral decision not to go to Iraq. Well, that was partly true, but it's also true that we were polling for the government of the day nightly on that issue, and the support for it, which most Canadians supported. People forget this. The support for going to Iraq was actually decisively in the majority.
Really? That's interesting.
It unraveled basically when the Coalition of the Willing became a substitute for the aegis of the United Nations.
Right.
And it came unraveled particularly quickly in Quebec, where military action's always been viewed with more tepid enthusiasm than the rest of the country. Mm. But that was what happened in that time. So, yes, we made the right decision, but it was guided by both morality and the polls.
I want to move to some other issues, but before I leave sort of world affairs and Canada's place in the world, do you have any sense of how important it is for Canadians in voting intentions or in the way they see themselves on the ideological spectrum, how world affairs play into that, or do people sort of define themselves more along the axis of domestic issues?
That's a very good question, and there are instances where issues related to world affairs, be they signing a NAFTA agreement or be they, you know, Vietnam or Iraq or other things, become extremely important. But for the most part, I think they're an important ingredient of a broader optic that the public have on what the government stands for and how that's conveying Canada to the world and how we feel about ourselves and our role in the world. And it's interesting to note that even though we see some evidence that Canadians are becoming adverse to more military adventure, it doesn't mean that they are becoming isolationist or more parochial. Canadians are quite cosmopolitan. They think that the world is an important arena for Canada, whether we be there as traders or in development roles or diplomatic roles, and occasionally in responsibility to protect. It is an important ingredient of how Canadians look. And so it can have an influence on how people will vote, but it's not the ballot booth question. People are not going to go in and say, oh, my God, I don't...
Who's got the foreign policy I like?
Yeah. There may be occasions where it becomes a ballot booth issue, but I think it's an important ingredient of how people form their choice.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with the founder of the polling firm Ecos Research, Frank Graves.
One big name that took part in the Canada 2020 conference is Jean Charest. He once served as the federal leader of the Progressive Conservatives before becoming the leader of the Quebec Liberals and serving three consecutive terms as premier of the province. Charest sits down with McLean's political editor, Paul Wells, to discuss a variety of hot political topics. But Paul starts by trying to find out if Jean Charest wants to get back into politics.
Every time you show your face in Ottawa and talk politics, someone says he wants Stephen Harper's job. Let's just start by getting you on the record on that. Do you want back into politics?
The answer is no. And I got into trouble. You and I talked about this earlier this summer because, you know, the answer you give, the honest answer is you never say never because who knows where life will lead you. But I'm very happy with what I'm doing. I'm with the law firm of McCarthy Tetreault. I travel a lot. I participate in public debates. But I have no yearning to return in politics and no plan, certainly, to do that. And I don't ever see myself returning.
Okay. Your in a little bit of a reminiscing mood this week because the Canada-Europe trade agreement has been signed, and the text is revealed, and it looks like it's going to happen. And I don't think people understand the extent to which this began as a Jean Charest project, as a you convinced Harper, among others, along the way.
In 2006, a number of people came to me because Canada had a negotiation going on with Europe that was really not going anywhere on investment. And the Doha round, which was the World Trade Organization negotiations, had stopped. And the idea was, why don't we propose a trade deal to Europe? And they were looking for someone to take on that idea. And that was the Canada-Europe Roundtable. Roy McLaren at the time was the chair of it, still is, I think. And I did take it on and consulted with industry and thought this is a good idea to do a broad trade agreement that could be a new generation agreement. We convinced the Europeans to get on board. The Harper government did take up that idea, and to Stephen Harper's credit, he carried it and delivered on it. And it's now the most advanced trade agreement in the world, the most comprehensive one. And for Canada, it carries huge potential because it allows us to be first movers in terms of a trade deal with a very rich consumer market, 500 million people. And I'm delighted that we're doing this because Canada needs new trading partners, and we need to be less dependent on the United States.
The Prime Minister did the negotiation, of course, in the Harper style, which was to determinedly low bridge it. It was very low profile for many years. Were you nervous? It could hardly be more different from the Brian Mulroney style of doing a trade negotiation.
In the end, yes, we were nervous, and I say we because the number of us who followed it and were involved in it felt that if it went on too long, the negotiations with the United States will creep into the room, and in fact, that did start happening. And when we sold this to the Europeans, Paul, we said to them, if ever you negotiate with Canada, it would be a good idea for you to have a deal with the United States. It would be a good idea to have a deal with Canada first, and that way you can lean on the Canadian deal to get more, and which is true. Now, the negotiations between Europe and the United States has started, and the danger for us as it went on is that both negotiations meld into one, which would not have been in the interest of Canada because it dilutes our interest. And there's still a danger because this thing hasn't been approved yet on the European side. And I think you're going to see some creeping in of the U.S. negotiations as the approval process will go ahead. And we have to be very vigilant about that to avoid our interest being mixed in with another country.
Okay. Now, here at the Canada 2020 conference, among your duties today was to take part in a panel on energy and the environment. I was struck by your remarks about bringing in Aboriginal populations. You say essentially it can't be done if you don't. You have to start from the beginning. I've heard similar things from Christy Clark in British Columbia, from Jim Prentice, the new premier of Alberta. The federal government seems to have been slow to get that message.
Well, on the issue of climate change in general and on some projects, I think the federal government has been more reticent about getting involved and being activists on that. And frankly, at the end of the day, a number of projects are not going to happen if the First Nations are not part of it, period. So let's, recognize that and act accordingly. And the other experience I have, Paul, on projects is the more you work upstream on any given project, the more chances you have of succeeding. And as opposed to just coming in front of someone and saying, well, here's a mine project, here's a pipeline project, are you for or against it, or what are your conditions? You may end up doing it, but it's going to be a lot more work as opposed to working upstream. So if we learn those lessons well, it will allow us to have better projects and to better serve the environment, by the way, to have better decisions on how we execute.
One, I guess, probably last subject I want to touch on is university tuition fees.
Yeah.
It preoccupied you during your last year in office. There were demonstrations, often violent demonstrations, across the province. And the next Liberal government to get elected, the current Liberal government, has essentially adopted PQ policy on tuition fees. Do you feel like you put in a lot of effort for not a lot of result?
Well, I didn't get the result I wanted, and I fought an election over it, and I was happy to have fought the election over it because I believed in it, and I thought it was important for us to go all the way and to force that issue into a campaign where people would vote. Now, we lost that campaign by 0.7% or something, so it was very, very close. Now, and Quebec is going to be in a tough situation now because the universities are underfunded and there's not a lot of places to go. The government already funds universities on a per capita basis more in Quebec than anywhere else because of low tuition fees. And if they want more funding, frankly, that's where they have to go. And the policy we had was fair. It was very reasonable, but it got caught up in a bigger play to try to hurt the government. I don't disagree with Couillard. If I were them, honestly, I'm not sure I'd reopen the file because of the past history.
It's too early to fight that again?
I think it's too early, and I went through it, the campaign, the PQ, and afterwards. He has, and that government has, a lot of issues to deal with in terms of containing spending, making choices. And I think they're right to focus on a number of issues, and who knows, eventually they may get to that matter, and maybe they'll do it in a better environment, and hopefully they'll do it better than I did, with a better outcome.
Okay. PQ is in a leadership cycle.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for Péquistes as they try and pick their next leader?
Oh, and it'll be interesting to watch. Very interesting to watch. And because one of the phenomena of the last campaign is that the separatist option has moved from mainstream to a more marginal place. It hasn't disappeared and it won't ever disappear, which I think it's important for your audience to understand. It's not as though it's going to go away. That'll never happen. But it's not mainstream anymore, and yet if you listen to the media in Quebec, it's as though they're still, you know, center stage. So I'm not sure how it will evolve. I know that the separatist option is not something Quebecers want, and it'll be very interesting to see how they'll choose. And the whole issue will be, do we do a referendum faster or sooner? And the rest of Quebec is somewhere else. It's just unusual to... I don't know who will win. Mr. Péladeau seems to have, in the polling at least, an advance. And he's right-wing. I mean, we know that. All of us know that he's someone who is clearly on the right wing of Quebec politics, much more than anyone else. But the PQIS as a movement is social left-wing, social democratic, separatist. How does he fit in? So it'll be interesting to watch.
That's Maclean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with former Quebec Premier Jean Charest at the Canada 2020 conference.
Once again, you can watch all of our interviews from the conference at macleans.ca. Coming up on the show, we speak with Green Party leader Elizabeth May about her life in politics. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Elizabeth May is best known as the leader of the Green Party of Canada, but many people may not know her political career spans decades. From her efforts to create a new federal party back in 1980 to her work as an environmental advisor to the Mulroney government to being the first ever elected member of the Green Party in the House of Commons, May has had quite a life.
And so she's put it all down on paper. May has released her political memoirs entitled Who We Are, Reflections on My Life in Canada. May sits down with Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca, to discuss her book and her friendship with U.S. President Bill Clinton.
Elizabeth May, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So Who We Are, your new book, the first question I have about the publication is, why now?
Well, I wanted to explain to Canadians a lot of what I see happening behind the scenes in Ottawa. I do it a lot for my constituents. I feel that as their employee here in Ottawa, I want to share what I'm experiencing. On the other hand, it needs context. And my publisher didn't want me to write a big book on policy. So we met halfway. And so why now is before an election, I'm hoping Canadians will share my view that we are losing our way. We're not the same people we thought we were. And maybe we were never quite as good as we thought we were. And being thoughtful about that and recognizing that we have within us a set of values and strengths that as Canadians bring us more together than divide us, I wanted to share my thoughts before an election, basically. But it's not a political tract. It's not very partisan. It's really about what kind of future I think Canada can have. But it's going to take an awful lot of work to pull ourselves back to being a really effective democracy.
Right. Can you talk a bit about how you came to know President Clinton? You talk about it in the book, but I think people
sure.
will probably... Just like to learn a little bit more about that, because that seems like a pretty interesting relationship for a current federal leader to have with a former U.S. president.
Yes. Well, he, of course, when I met him, he wasn't. He was a Yale Law School student. Mm-hmm. So I was born in the States. This is a big theme in my early years, and talk about in the book, my mother's activism. And she was very involved through my whole life in numerous campaigns, leading to being involved in anything to try to stop the war in Vietnam. And in 1971, in the summer of 1971, Bill Clinton, a young Yale law student, made an appointment to come meet with us, knocked on the door, he wanted to meet my mom because she was a very effective organizer. And Senator George McGovern was putting together his campaign team, and they were asking my mom if she would volunteer and work in the McGovern for President campaign. So, I mean, I don't mind telling you, I don't quite describe it like this in the book, I don't think, but I was 17 years old. I opened the front door, my knees caved, and I think, oh my God, this beautiful. Anyway, never mind. Bill at law school was quite something. And I was making iced tea and bringing it to the back porch for my mom and Bill. And he was really, really wonderful to me always. He treated me like an older brother. He was thoughtful and kind, and immediately, because he could see I had a pretty serious crush, I heard all about Hillary Rodham, this incredibly brilliant Yale law student who was his girlfriend. And I even got to like her too, which took some doing. Anyway, we became friends and stayed friends. And then my family moved to Cape Breton Island and opened a restaurant and gift shop. So I didn't go to university. I stayed waitressing and cooking in my family's restaurant. And one day, a bus tour, I was waiting on these lovely people, and they had this soft southern accent that really reminded me of Bill's accent. So I said to them, by any chance, are you folks from Arkansas? And they said, well, yes, we are. Now, how do you all know that? And I said, well, I had a crush, a really bad crush on a guy from Arkansas once. They said, well, who was that? And I said, well, his name was Bill Clinton. Ah, governor? And they're all looking around anyway. So that's how we reconnected. The bus driver, ran into Bill on the streets of Little Rock when they got home and said, we ran into some people, know y'all, up in Canada somewhere. So Bill sent the bus driver with a package of things for us. And after that, he would invite my mom to every inauguration. We got back to being in touch and friends, and then he wasn't governor for a while, and then he was again, and then he ran for president. So we are, against all odds, I'm federal party leader of the Green Party of Canada, and one of my longtime friends is the former president of the United States. He's just as kind and thoughtful and caring as he could possibly be.
That was Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca, speaking with Green Party leader Elizabeth May about her new memoirs, Who We Are, Reflections on My Life and Canada. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.